This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, June 20th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. The Export-Import Bank supplants private sector activity. It actively subsidizes mostly massive, profitable U.S. companies, and it often facilitates harm to downstream U.S. companies. So ending that bank would seem to be an easy litmus test for a GOP that desperately needs credibility on restraint of spending. Dan Eikenson, Director of Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, makes the case for ending the Export-Import Bank.
So in order to facilitate international trade, U.S. companies need to find creditworthy companies abroad to buy their products. And often that requires export financing. For some reason, since 1934, the United States has had the Export-Import Bank, which is designed to provide financing for foreign companies to buy U.S. products. The reason is that when a U.S. company sells abroad and it has to go 30, 60, 90 days without getting any payment, that produces an impediment to trade. So there is clearly a need for financing these sales so that U.S. exporters get money up front or sooner. But there's absolutely no reason the private sector can't be serving this demand. So EXIM has turned into sort of a subsidy for big U.S. companies by providing low-rate financing, below-market financing to foreign purchasers, or providing financing in cases that the market might deem too risky. So they're either putting taxpayer dollars at risk in those cases, or they are muscling in on private sector territory, banks that could be financing these operations.
Who are the big beneficiaries from the Export-Import Bank?
Well, the biggest U.S. company is Boeing. In fact, the Export-Import Bank is dubbed Boeing's bank. We also have, you know, Caterpillar and GE, companies that tend to make large sales. The EXIM Bank likes to say, hey, we're available to all types of U.S. exporters, small and medium enterprises. And there are, you know, thousands and thousands of transactions that they underwrite, but 80% of their largesse goes to the benefit of Boeing.
80%?
Correct.
So that's more than $30 billion in loans guaranteed?
Well, it depends on what time horizon you're looking at. On an annual basis, in 2014, the budget for EXIM is $160 billion. They have guaranteed loans, provided loans, or provided working capital to the tune of about $37 billion this year. But they have a big portfolio out there right now. Defenders of the EXIM Bank say, hey, we need this because we can't possibly make sales to foreign countries, foreign customers, when we're competing against export credit agencies in China or Europe, who are throwing a lot more money to try to facilitate these sales. The problem, though, is that we're not benefiting U.S. exports in general. We're not creating U.S. jobs in general. We are transferring those resources because there are U.S. companies that are hurt when EXIM subsidizes Boeing sales to, say, Air India, a commercial airliner in India. It is providing a lower capital cost structure for this company, makes it easier for Air India to lower its prices to compete with, say, Delta Airlines or any other American airline. We are giving a leg up to the competitors of U.S. downstream companies.
And this is being done in the name of helping U.S. Not just companies but the broader economy.
That's right. So you'll hear politicians or big business lobbies say, you know, this is a win-win. We are the Export-Import Bank is committed to growing U.S. exports and exports create U.S. jobs. What's not to like about this? Well, what they don't tell you is that, well, there are downstream effects. When U.S. taxpayer dollars are being used to underwrite the sales of particular companies abroad, we have to think of the customers of those U.S. companies in the U.S. So in Air India's case, Delta. When EXIM dollars are used to help sell mining equipment and heavy earth-moving equipment to Australian mines, Caterpillar equipment, GE equipment, it reduces the price of minerals, and it makes it more difficult for U.S. mines to make ends meet. About $8 billion over the past 7 years, about $8 billion worth of EXIM's largesse goes for exports of metal products, about $2 billion for chemical products, I think about $5 billion for transportation equipment. A lot of these products are components of manufacturing. So we are subsidizing foreign manufacturers by reducing their cost of production. Then they come back to the United States and compete with U.S. companies here and around the world. So we're making it easier for the competition of downstream U.S. companies. We're making it harder for them to compete. So I find it almost indistinguishable, the EXIM Bank program, from the sugar program or from steel tariffs. In those cases, we are overtly restricting imports to benefit an upstream producer. But you know, when we limit imports of steel, we hurt steel-using industries in the United States. This is the same process in reverse.
I am reminded of when you talked about metal producers in the United States. There's I'm reminded of the construction of solar panels that we've talked about on numerous times. And it seems that in a lot of trade issues, Export-Import Bank just being one of them, it's the downstream producers or consumers in the United States, be they consumers of intermediate goods or end product consumers, all of us, who are sort of the unseen. That is the unseen losers in all of this.
Exactly. This is a classic example of Bastiat's, you know, that which is seen and that which is not seen. We have this habit to just look at the first order effects of policy. You know, we need to increase exports or we need to create jobs. And this policy on its face will do that. Oh, but don't look at, you know, the consequences. Don't look at the downstream effects. And there are always secondary effects. And there are a lot of losers from this policy. So right now, the EXIM Bank's charter is set to expire on September 30th. And there is a chance that it won't be reauthorized. It's an issue that is one of many issues, I think, that is dividing the Republican Party. What's different this go-around from previous chapters is that the chair of financial services is Jeb Hensarling, who is an adamant opponent of EXIM, and the reauthorization legislation has to come through his committee. He has decided to allow hearings, which are taking place next week, but it's unclear exactly what's going to happen. There is a lot conservative Republicans want to make this an important issue to distinguish what their party's about from the establishment, and we'll see how that plays out.
What is the budget of the organization? What's their budget authority? How much do they spend?
Well, right now the budget authority, they have $160 billion.
Now, they don't spend that every year.
They don't spend
it every
year.
But they have the authority to do so.
They do. So so far, this year it was in the low 30s, I believe, or the most recent year. But they have a big portfolio that's outstanding because most of the loans that they make are on a long-term basis. You know, and they make the case that, look, without EXIM, we wouldn't be able to make sales because there, in certain instances, the risk is too high. Well, there are all sorts of private sector vehicles for funding high-risk loans. So EXIM is really muscling in on U.S. banks or other banks, private sector banks that could underwrite this. And if, in fact, the private sector would deem a transaction too risky to be funded at an affordable interest rate, then they're putting taxpayer dollars at risk, and neither of those excuses makes sense.
This seems like a fairly easy litmus test, or it ought to be a fairly easy litmus test for fiscal conservatives to say, look, if you want to be called a fiscal conservative at all, this is the opportunity.
That's right.
And it's not sufficient, but it is necessary, right?
That's right. It's pretty clear that there is an obvious market solution here. You know, what Boeing and the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and various other groups are pushing back on is saying, you know, we can't compete with other governments' credit agencies, and we're going to lose those sales. That's nonsense. The companies that are underwritten here are highly profitable. They have huge advantages, and I just can't imagine that a sale would be lost because of a long-term interest rate of, say, 2.5% versus 3.5% when U.S. producers have so many advantages in other areas that their competitors in China or Europe don't. You can find that make that difference up somewhere else.
To what extent do these foreign credit agencies provide the same function as the Export-Import Bank? Is it basically the same?
You know, more or less.
So then the question to ask, I would think, would be, well, if you accept the idea that we are, by providing this credit to U.S. companies for export, that we are subsidizing foreign companies that make use of those exports to compete with Americans, well, why wouldn't we care? Why would we not allow other countries to provide that same subsidy to U.S. companies?
Yeah, that's right. We should take the money and run. You know, I have some sympathy for concerns about competing. I believe in markets, and there are impediments, and the scales are tipped in various countries. Ideally, we would have some sort of a multilateral agreement to just not subsidize our exporters. It makes absolutely no sense. But in order to get there, the United States needs to lead because, you know, we're the ones who talk about free markets all the time, and we're the ones who seem to be the most hypocritical about it. We should unilaterally stop doing this kind of thing, and we can start by not reauthorizing the bank on September 30th.
Dan Eikenson directs the Herbert A. Stiefel Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. You can read more on the problems caused by the XM Bank at our website, cato.org.